This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place, whether you're in the mood for a new season of contemporary arts, new music from an acclaimed jazz musician, or an exhibit that literally shows you the money. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The Contemporary Arts Center begins its 40th anniversary season with a vision of the future, with interdisciplinary works from local, regional, and international artists. Joining me is CAC Director Neil Barclay and Andrea Anderson, Curator of Visual Arts. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Diane. Good to be here.
Congrats on your new season and to the organization's 40th anniversary.
Wow. We're really both grateful and excited and really looking towards what comes next.
And that is my next question. What comes next? You're talking about interdisciplinary works. What exactly is that, and how will it improve our concept of the CAC moving forward?
This interdisciplinary nature, meaning mixing more than one discipline, dance and music, dance and visual arts, theater and visual arts, etc., has become really part and parcel, if you will, of the work that we really get excited about.
What can we look forward to this season?
There are sort of thematic thrusts that are really coursing through across both our performing arts and our visual arts season. I think if there was a single way to look at the full programming that we have in this year ahead, it's really a year of rediscovery, partially rediscovering ourselves institutionally and what we will become. But I mean that in a really kind of revelatory way about the most basic objects and forms. Jasper Johns has a wonderful quote where he says, take something, do something to it, do something else to it. And it becomes something else in each case. You know, we start our season with the work of Zoe Juniper in performing arts. She's taking shape note music, which has its history in the Protestant church, and secularizes it and reframes it and retools it. What's interesting to me about this work is that it's not a situation in which the previous associations are eclipsed, but rather they continue to resonate even as they get layered into a new complex organization. There's another work that's on view during our first exhibition of the season, A Building with a View, Experiments in Anarchitecture, and two local artists, Rick Snow and Jebney Lewis, they retool these horn instruments and use them as pieces within a map, but they still sound, so they can figure in these different ways. We'll be having Rashad Newsom's work in January. He's born and raised in New Orleans and is coming back for this exciting interdisciplinary performance. All of his work is really fundamentally about collage, and so taking pieces that have lived other lives and reworking them and reorganizing them to mean something else.
Now, you mentioned a word, anarchitecture.
Yes. It's an elision between two words, anarchy and architecture. It is a word that talks about organizations of people coming together across disciplines to open up holes in things we think we know, particularly things that have been neglected, forgotten, and reimagining how we might purpose them.
Which is exciting. We follow that by a piece called Lipstick by Flock. Meryl Merman, a local choreographer, doing a piece that's accompanied by solo violin and a tube of lipstick. That's all I will say about that. A really fun and exciting and interesting exploration. Juarez, a documentary mythology with Theater Me Too coming in, really looking at what used to be called the murder capital of the world through stories that were told by people that actually lived in Juarez, Mexico. And this is weaved into a theater piece with projections and other kinds of theatrical devices to really capture what it's like to live in a place that has been wrecked by violence and dysfunction, but now is really finding its footing and is coming out of that to become another kind of place and home for the people who live there. Notes of a Native Son, Stu and Heidi, their Tony Award nominees, looking at the work of James Baldwin through song and music and spoken word. And then we have two more pieces, Newphonia Must Fall, Kid Koala, known for his work with Gorillaz. He's a DJ, he's a musician, he's a graphic novelist. He's doing a live adaptation of this novel that he wrote, Newphonia Must Fall. And it's described as a love story with a tone-deaf robot. And it's in the who's in the midst of an existential quandary. I was just wondering, what's he to do as a young robot now that life is changing all around him? And finally, we close with Goat in the Road, the critically acclaimed theater company. They've been doing a lot of research on the history and science of trauma. This piece explores the worlds of some of the victims of trauma and how they learn or maybe relearn how to navigate the world. It's a great season.
I think the whole season can in some ways be distilled around this interesting navigation between what is constant and what is variable so that you can really recognize how things are shifting around us.
CAC director Neil Barclay and Andrea Anderson, curator of visual art. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More info on the CAC's 40th anniversary season is online at cacno.org. Herlin Riley is one of the most in-demand drummers in music. His new CD, New Direction, also spotlights his considerable talent as a composer. New Direction got a rave review from the New York Times and is getting lots of airplay around the country. WWNO's Fred Kasten recently visited with Herlin Riley. Their conversation moved from Riley's deep musical roots to New Direction.
Herlin Riley grew up in New Orleans' Ninth Ward, part of a family with deep musical roots.
The branches spread out kind of wide here. I come from a musical family, of course, the Lastie family. My grandfather's name was Frank Lastie. He played the drums in the church. He was one of the first people to play the drums in the church in New Orleans. He was born in 1902. He played with Louis Armstrong in 1913 in Wave's home. He had three sons who were also musicians. Melvin Lastie played the trumpet. David Lastie played the saxophone, and Walter Lastie, we call him Papi, he played the drums. And all three of these guys were my biggest influences. They had a combo called the Lastie Brothers Combo. They used to rehearse in my grandparents' house, and I was primarily raised by my grandparents because I lived with them, you know, growing up. And as a toddler, they would actually wheel my crib into the room, you know, let me play in the room where they were actually rehearsing. And that would be like my pacifier. It kind of quieted me down. And so nothing about jazz music was ever foreign to me. Like water is not foreign to us. You know, we always, as long as we've been alive, there's been water for us to drink. And so music has always been like that kind of way, that kind of thing for me. It's always been around. It's always been a part of my life. When I was a little boy and I was a young, very young fella, I got to go to church with my grandparents maybe three or four times a week. And in doing that, my grandfather was playing the drums, and I would sit next to him, next to the drums. And as soon as he got up to go speak or to do something, you know, in the service, and there was an opportunity for me to play the drums, I'd jump behind the drums, man, at every opportunity just to get a chance to play. And so those years, you know, was so important to me because it was like my first time playing in front of people, just playing in front of people and playing, you know, in the church. It gave me a sense of confidence to be able to play. Mm-hmm. And not only that, you know, my grandfather, you know, when I was young, I was being influenced by so many different music, you know, James Brown and, you know, Ray Charles and, you know, Otis Redding, all this kind of music and stuff. And this James Brown beat was coming and I didn't want to try to play it because I'd heard it, you know, I heard it. So I wanted to try to play that beat. And my only opportunity to play was in church. So when I got to church, I would kind of switch up the beat a little bit and kind of try to slide a little James Brown rhythm in there, like Cold Sweat or something, try to slide that into the church music. And my grandfather would look at me with this look, man, like go right through me, like pierce through me. And he'd shake his fingers, none of that. Don't do that here. You know, you play this church music. You play this like this, you know, like play it straight. Don't put all that other stuff in there. You know, and it made me understand, you know, there are certain grooves that fit certain things and certain things that, you know, that's out of place. And so it helped me understand, you know, how to play within the context of whatever the groove that's going on.
Herlin Riley has employed that approach very successfully for decades. As a sideman with some of the finest ensembles and most accomplished musicians on the planet, including the Wynton Marsalis Septet, Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, McCoy Tyner, Ahmad Jamal, Monty Alexander. In recent years, he's begun to focus more time and energy on leading his own groups, and his new CD, New Direction, celebrates those efforts. New Direction is, I believe, and many observers concur, the most fully realized document to date of Herlin Riley's remarkable artistry as a drummer, composer, and bandleader. Riley wrote 7 of the 10 tunes on New Direction, including what became the title tune.
The groove from the tune was influenced by a project I did with Winton about 10 years ago. It was the music of a Brazilian composer by the name of Mansur Santos. And he's considered like the Duke Ellington of
the big band composer and scores films.
In Brazil. And so he had a tune, he had one of the tunes on the CD the show that I did, actually, one of the tunes that had that kind of groove on it. And I just played, that groove always stuck with me, and I wanted to do something with it. And I started hearing the bass line to go against that groove. And one thing led to another, and I started hearing the melody and the chords, and just put it together. But it was influenced basically by that particular groove that I was playing.
Direction features a couple of beautiful ballads by Herlin Riley, including A Spring Fantasy.
What was influenced by my experiences, I did a tour with Annie DeFranco about 5 years ago. She had a tune that she had written that had the structure of how the rhythms of how the chords are laid. Ding, ding, so she had a tune that had that kind of feel to it. So I was just messing with the piano one day, and I started playing something that had that kind of same kind of groove to it. And then I just kept working and then reworking it and reworking it, and then now we have Spring Fantasy. Everything is, I'm influenced by something. Something is, you know, triggered an idea, triggered a thought. You know, it could be the smallest little thing, and you know, you can, you know, just take that little spark, that little small bit of information, and you can create a whole piece out of it.
Work it back.
Yes.
Work it as it demands.
Yes, and I always do like to you know, I like to give credit to where it comes from. You know, some people. I'm not ashamed because I'm a product of my whole environment, and if something in the environment influences me, it came from there. I'm not copying anybody. I'm not copying anything, but that is definitely, it can influence me in a certain area.
In addition to the 7 Herlin Riley compositions on New Direction, there are 2 by the superb young pianist on the CD, Emmett Cohen, Herlin's Hurdle and Harlem Shuffle, and 1 by the great Danny Barker, Tutti Ma.
I knew Danny had recorded that tune, but then I heard a version that Lucian Barberin did of that tune. And Shannon Power and I were together one day, and he said, "Man, I want you to check out Lucian's CD, man. Check out this tune he wrote, you know, check out Danny's tune, Tutti Ma." So I heard Lucian's version of it, and I said, that's nice, man, I like that. And so then I got to hear Danny's version, you know, it's a little, much slower, and that kind of. So then I did my own arrangement of this tune, and so far so good. I think it's, you know, and I actually use the tune when I do my live gigs. I always close my shows out with that tune because it's very spirited. I can play the tambourine on it. I can sing a little bit on it, and it just has a real, real feel good kind of vibe to it. It's very, very uplifting. It kind of, you know, it's high energy, and it makes it something that makes you want to dance.
She did something against the law, took my fall right from my mouth. I'm gonna knock on the door.
Herlin Riley's highly recommended, critically acclaimed new CD is New Direction for 89.9 WWNO. I'm Fred Cast.
Tell me what you're working with. Yeah.
listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Now, we show you the money. The Historic New Orleans Collection has an exhibit that traces the history and art of currency in Louisiana. Eileen Fleming spoke with curator Aaron Greenwald about the show that's called, of course, Money, Money, Money.
I'm Aaron Greenwald. I'm a curator and historian here at the Historic New Orleans Collection.
Tell me a general update on what you learned.
In the 19th century, currency looked very different from the way that we see currency when we pull it out of our wallets now. And in fact, there was no uniformity. There were hundreds of banks across the United States printing literally thousands of different types of banknotes.
When did they all become uniform?
They didn't become uniform until the Civil War. In 1863 and 1864, the federal government passed legislation that allowed for the federal government to actually print and circulate currency, something that was prohibited by the U.S. Constitution. We have about 200 objects in this exhibition. Most of them are paper banknotes. We start in 1719 with two bills that were actually not circulated here in Louisiana, but are related to Louisiana's founding.
Okay, let's take a look at your first piece that you'd like to show.
Sure. So the earliest pieces in this exhibition are these two banknotes from the Banque Royale de France, which were circulated in France, not here in Louisiana, but were used to buy shares in a company premised on the value of Louisiana. This is what's known as leading up to the Mississippi Bubble. I don't know if you're familiar with this massive stock and real estate bubble that formed in France, premised on Louisiana being place of great value and abundance. Well, when word got out that Louisiana was not actually the colony that everyone had hoped for, there was a run on this bank, the National Bank of France. A panic ensued, and essentially the French economy collapsed. So these notes are related to Louisiana, but not used here.
Louisiana brought down the Bank of France?
They did, actually. Most of the American colonies, whether they were French or British or Dutch, they were reliant on the specie reserves of the Spanish colonies because they had mints in places like Bolivia and Peru and Mexico City. So the primary currency in the colonial period is Spanish.
So the French thought that we had lots of gold mine and copper mines and such?
They were very, very hopeful that we had mineral deposits, but they also thought they could create here a tobacco-based economy that would rival the Chesapeake.
Didn't happen.
Now we're going to go around the corner, and we're going to look into the early period when paper notes really began to flourish. Imagine trying to exist in an economy that is exclusively based on hard money. And then think about the expansion of the United States and how difficult it would be to get hard currency from one place to the next in an efficient manner. And so paper money as an alternative is born. So you don't have to haul the bags of coins from place to place, especially in frontier areas. But by the 1850s, you have hundreds of different banks each printing their own notes with different vignettes and different values, and they're all in circulation at the same time. Here in New Orleans, we had very good engravers. We had very high quality printing materials until the Civil War, when we lost access to a lot of those resources. But in the antebellum period, New Orleans is a growing, booming center for trade. New Orleans is a very important financial center. It rivals New York in terms of the amount of capital that is flowing in and out of the city.
So which is the prettiest?
Which is the prettiest? Well, I think some of the most interesting are the ones with unexpected vignettes. You see a lot of classical imagery on these notes, which is perhaps not surprising. You see founding fathers, but you also, particularly in New Orleans, you see imagery related to the societal values of this place. So you see a lot of trade and shipping references. This one here has boats, but also, you know, those mermaids that you see all the time in the Mississippi River. There's a merman and a mer lady.
There is a merman.
Yeah.
Leave it to New Orleans. I do see some coins over here, so let's take a peek.
The U.S. Mint in New Orleans still exists, so we just wanted to give a nod to minting operations in New Orleans and see it right here.
Teeny tiny.
Teeny tiny there. This is the smallest coin ever minted in the United States.
That's smaller than a dime.
It's a $1 coin, and it's 13 millimeters across.
Were they popular?
People hated them because they were so easily lost.
That would fall right through the cracks.
Yes. During the Civil War, you have a situation, especially in the South, where the Confederacy is attempting to finance this massive military campaign. But they do not have the resources, either in mineral wealth or in things like paper and engraving, that they really need to sustain the creation of a paper money economy. They start printing notes in 1861. And they continue printing throughout the Civil War. But imagine the difficulties of a place like New Orleans, which is captured by the Union and held by the Union fairly early on. This is a center of printing. It's taken by the Union. The Confederacy no longer has access to it. And so they are printing money in places like Columbia, South Carolina, and Richmond, Virginia. The state of Louisiana printed money throughout the Civil War. There are examples here. And here is a good way of understanding just how short paper was in terms of supply. On the fronts of these notes, you have State of Louisiana banknote denominations. On the backs, you see these are remainders or offcasts from other banks in other states.
Wow.
So they're reusing the paper.
Recycled money.
Yep.
Wow. Who do you hope to attract to this exhibit? Who do you think this would hold out a real interest for?
Well, this is an exhibition that focuses on the history of banking, but also looks at money as a reflection of societal values. So we're hoping to attract the general public. There are also plenty of things for collectors to see, although I'm sure collectors will have knowledge about some of these areas that we would benefit from, and we hope that they come in and share their knowledge with us.
Erin Greenwald, curator at the Historic New Orleans Collection, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The exhibit is on display through October 29th at the Williams Research Center at 410 Charter Street. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.